This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
But we ended up at a fairly small church, and we became a part of that church, and a lot of people were surprised about that. Let me tell you why we did that. Because in the midst of all of this pain, and I remember driving to the church, and all of a sudden, if you leave a church, ministerial ethics require that you not maintain those relationships in the former church. You owe it to the new pastor that you not go back and do funerals and weddings except at his request, that you not go back and maintain those deep and abiding friendships that you had. So we cut all those off, and it was hard. And I remember driving to this church, Emmanuel, and saying to Anna, you know what I feel? And she said, yeah, you feel lonely, don't you? And I said, yeah, man, I feel so lonely. You know, we couldn't get the phone to stop ringing. We were doing something with people all of a sudden. And then immediately, all of it was cut off. Friends that we'd spent 20 years building were no longer friends. We could no longer have a relationship. It was a really hard time. And then I was going through all of the kind of stuff that we're going to be talking about as we go through this seminar. And when we came out of the church, Al LaCour evidently looked at us on the back row, and he really felt, contrary to Clinton, he really felt our pain. And when I came out of the church, he grabbed me and hugged me, and he whispered in my ear, he said, Steve, you're going through hell. He said, I want you to know, if you need a soft place, we'll be that for you. I won't make you preach. I won't have you teach. You don't have to sing in the choir. You can just sit on the back row, and you can allow some of those wounds to heal. Can't tell you how freeing and wonderful it was to have a pastor say that to me. Every church I went to, they said, hey, man, could you preach for us next Sunday? Hey, we have an adult Sunday school class, and if you would come in there, we could triple it. Man, we'll sell your books, and you can make some money, and our church will grow. And Al said, you're going through hell. You sit on the back row, and you just let the wounds heal. Well, during that period, and I realized that I was not at my emotional best during that particular time. But I was working on this seminar. I'd read more books than I can even remember to prepare for this seminar. And somebody had given me a set of tapes from John Bradshaw's seminar. Now, you need to know, I didn't know who John Bradshaw was. But I stuck them in the tape recorder. Whenever I'd drive somewhere, I'd listen to some of them. And I kept a notepad on the seat beside me so I could take some notes for the cognitive, theological, philosophical, and metaphysical principles that I was learning in this so I could teach them to other people once I applied them to myself. Well, if you're familiar with Bradshaw, one of the things that he does is that he doesn't just provide cognitive stuff for people to process. He then gives them a place to process it. And so they play this really soft music. And then he says to you in the meditation, I want you to close your eyes, and I want you to picture a place where you were as a child. And he said, I want you to go back to that place, and I want you to say to yourself as a child, I'm the only person who knows what you're going through. And if it's all right with you, I'd like to visit you on occasion. If it's all right with you, I'd like to get to know you because I'm what you're going to become. Now, obviously, I didn't close my eyes. And to be perfectly honest with you, I reached over to turn the tape recorder off to fast forward it back to the cognitive stuff, forward to the cognitive stuff. And he's playing, these violins are playing. And I'm thinking, I described it adequately, I want you to know, and wanted just the facts. Give me the facts. And before I could push the fast forward on the tape recorder, I found these tears welling up in my eyes. And within 2 minutes, I had to pull off to the side of the road, and I wept like a child. And I remember thinking, I'm going crazy. Man, I'm a fruitcake. There's something wrong with me. And then I started fast-forwarding to the soft music so I could listen to what happened next. And he goes through a period of exercises. The final one is when you say goodbye, you take your lost child, you champion your lost child, and you say goodbye to the parents and to the past. And so he takes you to this place where you go into these rooms, and they're big screens in each of these rooms, and they relate things that happened in your past. And then the last scene, he has you taking your lost child, the one you're championing, and walking down a long hallway with the parents at the other end of the hallway. And he has you turn with your lost child and say, goodbye. I want to thank you for all the good things you did for me, and I want to forgive you for all the bad things that you did for me. But I've got another life now, and I'm going there. Now, I know what some of you guys, especially those of you who are theological, you're thinking, oh, jeez, I wouldn't even stay in this course if he weren't an easy grader. But let me tell you something. That kind of thing absolutely opened up stuff to me that I had never thought about before. I had not remembered things in my past. There were long periods in my childhood, and I had a miserable childhood, that I didn't even remember. And with that kind of stuff, as I said, it was like lancing a boil, and all of a sudden, I began to remember. And these memories came rushing back, just like a flood in my life. Lee Clower, and I may have told you this, and I debated all afternoon whether I was going to come back and go back to the prisons so I could share this other material. But trust me, you'll be glad by the end of the course because this worked out a whole lot better. But at any rate, Lee Clower, who's my friend at First Presbyterian in Chattanooga, he's a drunk, but he's recovering. He's an Air Force fighter pilot. He's big sucker, mean. One time I had failed to say exactly the right thing about abortion at First Presbyterian when I was speaking, and a guy came up with a paper sack. I didn't know it was a bomb or what it was. It turned out to be a baby doll, and he wanted to stick it in my face and start yelling at me. I talked to him for a while. I didn't know what to do, and Lee just gently came down and looked at him like, squirt, come with me, and he walked him away. But Lee's the one that says that religion is for people who don't want to go to hell, and Christianity is for people who've been there. And Lee's been there. He's been there in every way that you know, and he's gone through some really heavy therapy with some Christians. And I called him up because he's the only guy I knew. And I said, man, I'm going through a tough time. And I think it's what you went through before, and I'm remembering stuff I never remembered before. Really painful stuff. And I said, I've got these sleeping dogs in my life, and I'm going to wake them up, but I've got a .38, and if they try to bite me, I'm going to shoot those suckers. And then I was in Chattanooga for a radio rally. They call them an evening with Steve, about 3 weeks later. And I was, after the thing was over, people were standing around. I was talking to people, and he just elbowed his way through. And he's big enough to do that. And he said, Steve, got a message from the Lord for you. And I said, Lee, you're reformed. You don't have messages from the Lord. He said, no, man, the Lord told me to tell you something. I said, all right, what did he tell you to tell me? He said, for me to say to you, you wake up those sleeping dogs because they don't have any teeth. And he was right. And then another friend of mine who also lives in Tennessee, there are a lot of weird folks in Tennessee, and his name is Martin Burke, and he'd gone through some of those kinds of things. And he said, Steve, I know what, he called me, he said, Steve, I know what you're going through. He said, man, those demons are pretty scary, aren't they? And he said, let me tell you what to do. Kiss them on the mouth. I said, what? He said, kiss them on the mouth. Kiss them on the mouth and they die. And you know, it turned out that wasn't very theological. They didn't quote any Bible verses to me. They didn't give me a system. They didn't give me Bill Gothard and say, get over it. They told me what I needed to hear and what you need to hear as Christians, and that is that demons do die in the dark. I said last week that the problem with the recovery movement is that it's another addiction, and it really is. Do you think that if you hear the word codependent one more time, you're going to scream? You know, people get into this, and it becomes the focal point of their life. It's where they get their ego strokes. It's where they get their meaning, and they define themselves in terms of their own addictions. In the John Bradshaw group, for instance, these people bring teddy bears. to these seminars. And they go to seminar after seminar after seminar after seminar, and they are championing their lost child. Who was it that said, I went back and found my lost child, and then I took him out and I shot him? And you feel like that about this Bradshaw stuff, that it's become this kind of in-group of people who know Goodwill Hunting. It's not your fault. It's your parents' fault. And I believe that some of the things you are today have to do with your past. But I think there is a point, and this is where AA has got it right, when you assume responsibility for all of that. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. I do not have a 12-step program. I have a 7-step program. I also only have 8 commandments and a 7% tithe. So you're going to like this course. I just want you to know. But I have a 7-step program that we're going to talk about much later on when we get to that particular point. But let me say some things about, are y'all, don't remember, this isn't church, and you can talk to me if you want to. What I want to do is that I want to go and check out some of this material. Did I tell you about being in California with Dan, with my pastor friend, and his wife started crying at dinner and said, you have to be careful about this material. Well, I'm going to be careful with it, but I want to give you some handles that you can deal with the prison of the past, or with which you can deal with the prison of the past. And the first thing I want you to remember as you deal with these sorts of things in your life, and everybody got them. Some of you have them really bad because some really bad stuff happened in your past. Some of you have had mild traumatic things, and all of those things have affected our present, and I don't think Christians look at that very much. First, the child is lost. Psalm 51:5, David is looking at his sin, and he doesn't make any excuses, but he does present one salient fact, and that was the one I quoted to you before. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. In Luke 21:16, Jesus is talking about another context, but it's a reality that many people have experienced. You shall be betrayed by parents and brothers and kinfolk. Let me tell you about my mother, and I love my mother a lot. I always, in the liturgy that I use most mornings in my own time with God, there's a place where I go over each of the Ten Commandments and measure where I'm coming from in relationship to those commandments. And when I come to honor your father and your mother, I kind of wince because I tell about my father and my mother. My mother said, back when I first started this radio ministry and it was broadcast in her area, she used to huff and puff to her Sunday school class. And she said, all of my life I've been trying to keep the family secrets, and I've got a son who's out telling the entire world. And so I called our agency in California, and you need to know on our radio programs, we don't do any edits. If I make a mistake, we leave it there. If I stutter or mispronounce a word, we leave it there. And that drives engineers and agency people up the wall. They say, you can't do that. We want it to be perfect, like Chuck Swindoll and like MacArthur. And I said, no, leave it in there. Leave it all in there. And when we started doing that, our response tripled, because that's the way people do. People say stupid things. People mispronounce words. People don't get their grammar right. And so I told you, don't edit those tapes. Just send them out the way they are. But we had one exception to that. And I said to the engineer and the editor in California, whenever I say anything that is even mildly offensive to my mother, you cut it out. And so for years, whenever I would use an illustration that had to do with family, which was a necessary one because I believe God has called me to be honest about these things, the engineer would call me and say, man, you really blew it this time. I'm cutting it out, but you got to send us 5 more minutes because you talked about it for a long time. And so my mother didn't know all the stuff. And then I began to realize, because this year, when I resigned from the church, became a painful year in a number of ways. First was because I was defining myself in a whole different way. I was finding out if God loved me for who I was and not what I did for him. I was finding out also if some friends loved me for who I was instead of what I did. And then also during that year, both of my daughters got married, our daughters. Those of you who have daughters who aren't grown yet, you think you've got a good deal because God only sends boys to guys that need help, and daughters are always best. But let me tell you the truth, man. The day you marry them off is going to be one of the most bittersweet days of your entire life. Both of my daughters, within a three-month period, wanted me to perform the ceremony. And I said something like, "You're out of your mind. It's not that I don't want to. I can't do it. You'll be lucky if I even come to the wedding. I think I'm going to stand at the back of the church, shove you down the aisle, make an obscene gesture, and leave." But it got through it. But it was, you know, it was a major change in one's life. And I love my sons-in-laws. I really do, most of the time. But they're still gorillas. And there was a sense of tremendous loss when these two beloved, wonderful, perfect daughters were given to these gorillas. And then right after that, let me tell you what else happened. We were in Hurricane Andrew, and Andrew blew through, and we lost our house. And then a contractor stole $60,000. And then we had $15,000 lien on our house. And then they stole my car. And I said, "God, what have I done?" And God said, "Steve, there's something about you that just ticks me off." But let me tell you what happened. All that time, I was working on this seminar material, and I'm thinking, how am I going to do this and honor my mother? Now, she's in heaven, and she understands now. How am I going to do this? And the final bad thing that happened was her doctor, my friend in North Carolina who watched my mother. My mother was almost 90. She'd lived in the same house for over 70 years in the mountains. She didn't want to leave that place, and the doctor and I had a deal that when she could no longer do it, and he said she couldn't do it, she would come to live with us, and we had an apartment in our house waiting for her. Well, then God, in his wisdom, took our house away, just blew it away, man. And so we didn't have any place. So right in the middle of all this, my doctor friend calls and said, "Steve, it's time." I said, "No, it ain't time. Not this." And he said, "Yeah, and you got to do something." And so we moved to North Carolina. I took a tape recorder and a computer and a fax machine and a modem, set it out on the back porch in the mountains, and I did our radio programs. They sent me a small digital recorder from California, and I did all the radio programs from there, and then talked with my staff and did that thing for 3 months. And I did stuff that you don't expect that you're going to do with your mother. I became her nurse. And we did a lot of reconciliation, and I could just tell you story after story after story of that time. It was a wonderful time. My mother died in a way, you know, I've always said, when it comes my time to die, I want all of my friends to call their pagan friends and say, "Come, I want you to see how a Christian dies." Right now, that's not a very good prospect, and I don't want anybody to watch because I'm going to scream and cuss and kick. But I assume there will be dying grace the way there was with my mom. My mom, all of her friends came and said goodbye. She called our nephew. My brother had died just 4 or 5 years before. And he was my best friend. But she called the two boys, Jeff and Michael. And Jeff was dating a girl, and he had broken up with her and then gotten back together. So she called him to her deathbed. And she had taken Tuella's picture and had thrown it in the bottom of some kind of can in the house. And they got back together. And so she called Twilla in and said, "You love him?" She said, "Yes, ma'am, I do." And then she called Jeff in and said, "You love her?" She said, "Yes, ma'am, I do." She said, "Then marry him and remember I'm on my deathbed." And then she called my wife in and said, "Anna, go get that picture of Twilla. Put it back on the bureau so that people can see it at that time." But it was a wonderful kind of witness during that time. But during that time, I want you to know I really honored my mother. She was a Democrat and I was a Republican. My wife used to get so tickled. We'd sit and watch the Republican and Democratic National Conventions on television. My wife would be doing needlework and she'd be giggling. You could see giggling so hard sometimes the tears were coming out of her face because my mother and I decided we weren't going to comment. And so she would go at the Republican convention. And at the Democratic convention, I'd do the same thing. And my wife used to get so tickled at it. She said, "You're like two fighting bulldogs who've been restrained by some mysterious force, and you can't go after each other." But I honored my mother. I honored her in a wonderful way. And I want you to know, when she died, she knew I'd honored her. And so, but the interesting thing in God's providence was that, in fact, the first seminar was to start in Seattle. When I was called up to North Carolina, we canceled Seattle and St. Louis. while I waited for my mother to die. And now I can tell you stories about her. I love my mother a whole lot, I want you to know, and I honor her. And the great thing about the discovery that I found is that you're just as bad as she is, and I'm worse. That I've never found. So when I talk about people and the way they really are, it's not a put down, it's a statement of reality. We all have our stuff. We all have our bad stuff. And so when I talk about my mother, it's not dishonoring her, but talking about her. My mother one time wrote me a letter when I went off to college, and she had a hard time because she was married to a drunk. But she wrote me a letter and told me I was going to be just like him. She then described some of the bad things that I'd done for many years. And she told me that I would never make a contribution, that I could never be a pastor, and that I wasn't good enough. And I want you to know, I believed her. I railed against her, and I kicked the wall. And I told her I hated her for writing that letter, but I want you to know I believed her. I really did. And when she just had it up to her ears, and it was a hard, hard life, because he would blow the paycheck at the town pool hall. My daddy was an executive in a large textile firm. He ran shipping for 3 plants. One was in Holland. He was very good, but he would blow everything, gambling. And my mother had to somehow put clothes on us, and she bought my father's clothes. And when he was red-faced from being on a drunk for 2 weeks, she made him look good and sent him off to work. She pounded in us that we were to be good. She told us that you're going to make something of yourselves or I'm going to kick your posterior. My mother read Spurgeon in the morning. She read Bible at night. And she taught me how to cuss in between. She's the most earthy Christian I've ever known. She went to an insane asylum, a hospital for, that's not very politically correct, a hospital for the emotionally troubled. She decided that those people weren't crazy. She got a lawyer and got them out, and they were crazy, and they all came to our house. And I never knew when I came home whether it'd be some homeless. And nobody, the homelessness was not a big cause celeb in those days. She'd find somebody didn't have a house, she'd be feeding them, giving them a place to stay. And I never knew when that was happening. But I remember at 2:00 in the morning when she said, I've had it. I can't do this anymore. I'm out of here. And I remember feeling, oh, God, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to my brother? What are we going to do? Got a drunk dad and an absentee mother. And all my life I've been in awesome fear of abandonment. When I left the church, this church that I served for almost 20 years, you need to know that I buried their babies. I'd married them. I'd watched them grow up. I'd been their pastor all this time. And I'd fallen in love with them. And they loved me. And I found out later as I worked on this material that I had a lost child. And that the great pain of severance when I resigned was the feeling of abandonment. And so there is a child, and the child gets lost, and things get done to a lost child. I have a friend who, she did some prostitution for a while. She became a Christian, and she was doing her best to get it, and then she got on drugs, and she fell off again. And she had a picture that she obviously had carried all her life, and it was folded, and she had it in her billfold. And she was sitting in my study, and she took that picture out, and she was crying, and she flipped it across the table. And it was a picture of her as a little girl with a frilly dress. And she said, sometimes late at night, I look at that picture, and I think, oh, God, what have I done to that little girl? And as I haven't seen her in a lot of years, but I'd like to tell her now that it was the little girl who did it unto her, that there was stuff that happened then that had done stuff to her that affected her present life. Now, let me give you, okay, good.
Is this a universal experience?
Yes. It's because of Adamic sin. I've never found a place. Gary Rupp used to have a cartoon in his office where he had this gigantic convention hall, and there were 3 people in it. There's one way in the back and one way over here, and somebody sitting on the front row. And the caption said, "The annual convention of children of normal parents." I believe. By the way, and we'll talk about this a little bit later on when we talk about anthropology. But I genuinely believe that what we've been describing in a theological sense is exactly what I'm talking about here. I think you'll find a list of 18 kings where they all did bad. Why is that? Or you'll find God saying to the third and fourth generation, stuff happens, good and bad.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.